You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Hello and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached a little ditty we like to call Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast and YouTube channel that covers horror and science fiction films and television, key elements from those particular films or television, and elements that they then in turn influenced. If you're joining us for the first time, yay, great, nice to have you here. We'd love to know how you found us. Why don't you take just a second right now in that comment section in YouTube or in the comment section of your podcast choice and say, hey, this is how I found you guys. I love it. Also, if you wouldn't mind subscribing, that lets you know when a new episode is going to drop, which we try to do once a week. And also, you can get a library of all of our old stuff. You can also reach us, johnnyhasthekeys.com. I think that about covers the welcome. Oh, if you're joining us again, thank you. We're glad you're back and you're a valued patron and we love you. My name is David. I'm here with my co-host and podcast friend, Tim. Tim, how you been?
I have been great. That was quite the introduction there.
It was.
I liked it. Yeah. I liked it.
Thank you.
It was perfect.
Appreciate it.
I have been dabbling in various genre type things, mm-hmm. as we do, mm-hmm. as one does.
As one does.
Yeah, so I guess I will just dive in with what I happened to watch this week.
Okay.
And it is a movie called Scream Queen.
Ah, okay.
This movie, oh my God, I'm not going to remember that guy's name.
But there's a guy in it.
Yeah, it's the guy from, something Pattinson. No, that's the guy from Twilight.
Yes.
The one I'm thinking of is this guy was, the actor in the second Nightmare on Elm Street movie. You would recognize him though, because he was also in Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean.
Really?
Yes. He was a rising star in the late or mid to late 80s.
Okay.
And I'm going to look up his name because I'm a bad host and I don't have it in front of me.
You should have this all scripted out word for word, everything. So we basically just read the podcast.
No, I don't do that.
No, we don't. We don't do that.
His name is Mark Patton. I knew it was something Patton.
Mark Patton.
Yes. And he was in, I will look him up. He was in Come Back to the Five and Dime. He was Joe pre-sex change operation.
Okay.
Do you remember that? Does that ring a bell?
No.
Okay. Well, you remember the story, Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy.
Oh, yeah.
Jimmy,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's a great play. Robert Altman did the movie.
Yep.
This guy was on the rise. He was going to be a big star. He already had an agent. He basically walked in and they said, oh, yeah, we love your face. We're going to make you a star. And he got cast in the second Nightmare on Elm Street movie, which is Freddy's Revenge.
Okay. Yep.
And that movie was rushed, if you remember, because the first one was such a big success. And he signed on because he knew it was a success and he knew that this would just help his career. Well, it ruined his career. Because that movie ended up being very, how do I use the word? If you ever have said, I don't know if you've seen that movie anytime recently or heard anything about it, but there's a lot of homoerotic undertones in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
It has now been admitted by the writer that, yes, they were intentional. But for the longest time, he denied it. And this guy happened to be gay. And it ruined his career, basically.
Really?
Well, back then, you know, there was not only just homophobia in the movie industry, but there was AIDS phobia. And this guy also ended up being positive. He is still alive and on the convention circuit now. But so I kind of argue that some of what happened was probably because he was diagnosed with a deadly disease at an age when people really weren't surviving. So I think that may have had a little bit to do with it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie is fascinating. It gets 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. They go into his experience, and basically it is him reuniting with the cast and starting to go to conventions again, and his quest to confront the writer and get the writer to admit that he did all this shit on purpose.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. It is great. And he has had a resurgence. He basically left Hollywood in the late 80s and moved to Mexico. He left the country. And he has been living down there with his partner ever since. But now he is starting to come back, and he's on the circuit convention, or the convention circuit. You can actually go and see conventions he's playing at. One, I got emailed one the other day because of the fact that I've been watching these things and somebody's spying on me or something.
Your phone is listening.
But
yes.
Yeah. It's a fascinating thing. But what's so cool is that some of this footage was a few years back. Like, I think Clue Gulager is dead now,
mm-hmm.
but he wasn't when this was filmed. There's like, I want to say there was one, or maybe he's not in it. I think he's in it. But if you'll look at that one picture of the cast behind me, it's kind of hard to see their faces, but Robert Englund's in there,
yeah.
as are the other stars from the second movie, including the gym teacher and his best friend and the female love interest and all. Who looked a lot like Meryl Streep, by the way.
Hmm.
So anyway, it's a documentary. If you're a Nightmare on Elm Street fan, I highly recommend it. You will remember his face as soon as you see
it. I'm sure I will.
Yeah. So yeah. That is what I have been doing. Sorry for the delay and that I didn't remember Mark's name. Damn it.
Mark is going to look you up on the convention circuit, and you're going to be in trouble.
Yeah, I'm a great endorser.
Well,
what have you been doing?
I am proud this week because I actually had some time to catch up on, because, you know, so many times, you'll give me, oh, I watched these five movies and I watched this three. And I'll like, what did you do, David? Nothing really. I didn't have time to watch anything other than the film we're talking about and do all the research or whatever. But this time I actually got to catch up on two things that I've been wanting to. One is Murders in the Building. I had not watched it, so I caught up and watched the entire thing, and it was awesome. It was so good. They worked so well together. That cast was so good. Writing was good. I loved the whole arc of it. I'm glad they're going to do a second season. I thought that was great. I just saw recently that, you know, they've just, you know, completed principal photography the second season or whatever. So that's great.
It makes you wonder or question Chevy Chase in Three Amigos.
Yeah.
Did he really have anything to do with the success of that film?
Right. Or was did he just phone it in? You never know.
Yeah.
But I loved, you know, the character quirks they gave him really worked really well. I thought Selena Gomez held her own. That was some, you know, that's.
Oh, she's great.
That's rough holding up against, you know, trying to go against Short and Martin. That's.
Well, she's real good at playing straight man or straight woman. I guess you would say.
Yeah, but she also had that snarkiness vibe to her that really worked for that character. It was really good.
Right.
If you like comedy and mystery, Murders in the Building is great. And I love the podcast angle of it. I loved Martin Short kept saying, that was really good. Now, could you do it again? But give us more.
Yeah, he's to me the funniest thing in that. Actually, Steve Martin's great too, though.
Yes.
I mean, Steve does classic Steve several times in there. I'm like, oh my God, that reminds me so much of something he did 30 years ago.
So true. So true. Some of the stuff he does. There are no undead in it, though. So.
Okay. But there's plenty of undead in what we're discussing this week.
Oh God, yes. Look at our castles behind us. We have castles.
Yes. Creepy castles.
Yes.
We are in our second, let's say part two of our Dracula deep dive. Last week we did 1931's Universal's Dracula with Bela Lugosi, mm-hmm. as well as the 1958 version Horror of Dracula with Christopher Lee. This week, we are going a little closer to the present time with 1979's Frank Langella's version of Dracula with Laurence Olivier and Donald Pleasence, mm-hmm. as well as the 1992 version of Bram Stoker's Dracula, which was directed by Francis Ford Coppola, stars Gary Oldman, Winona Ryder,
Keanu Reeves,
and a bunch of other people. Oh, Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins, yes.
So, we have two more Draculas. How would you ask that I should synopsize them? Well, basically, like the first two, Dracula comes to England. different ways. A lot of characters are interchangeable and really hard to keep straight again. They love plucking names from the original Dracula novel and saying, okay, let's let the love interest be Mina. No, let's let the love interest be Lucy. Or,
well, I think the 79 does that. I do not think the Coppola version does that.
The Coppola version is by far the most faithful.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you wanted to synopsize it, I would say, if you want to synopsize the 79, read the play. If you want to synopsize the Coppola one, read the book.
Okay.
You know?
That makes sense. There's a lot more on ships in the first one as well. Not only does he come there by ship and she find him on the beach, but it also ends on a ship.
Yeah, they take a lot of liberties. But again, in the 79 version, it's, you know, basically the writer was W.D. Richter, who had done Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the remake, and then had gone on.
Nice.
Had gone on to do Buckaroo Banzai, Big Trouble in Little China. So a pretty good genre writer, but he based almost everything on the Hamilton Dean play that is also what the 31 version was based on.
And there's a lot that takes place in the asylum. And I believe you told me that play takes place in the asylum.
Exclusively in Seward's asylum. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. And the reason, you know, one of the reasons this movie was even made was because it was on Broadway at the time. It had been revived. It had come from London. It was in New York. And that's where they saw Frank Langella and said, wow, we need to make a movie.
Very much like, Bela Lugosi.
Yep.
Same thing.
Same kind of story.
Let's do the movie and let's put the same guy from the play in it.
Yeah. And one of my keys to it, though, is also it reminded me, and I think I said this in the 31 last week, but Rocky Horror Picture Show. You know, we saw this play. It was so good. Somebody needs to make a movie of this, you know, and they did. Langella is the biggest reason to watch this movie, I think. That's my take on it. He is really, really good in this role of giving this character charisma again. Something that, you know, we talked about, I think last week that Christopher Lee had, you know, he's charismatic in that only scene he freaking talks to people.
He has 16 lines in the whole film. Right.
But in this one, Langella is just all charisma all the way through. It's sexy time, you know, all the time in there. So, which is,
well, and very much like Lugosi, I can't remember if Lugosi insisted on this or not, but coincidentally, if not, neither one of them ever used fangs in the film.
Correct. I saw that was one of the stipulations of Langella's: no fangs and no blood on him. So no blood. Other people could have blood.
No blood on me.
No blood on, don't touch the face. Don't touch the face. You know, or whatever. But yes. It was interesting watching it again because I so remember this, watching it repeatedly on VHS and DVD.
I know that you're a big fan of the soundtrack. We used to listen to the soundtrack a lot.
I adore the soundtrack. I think it is John Williams, and it is post-Star Wars, but pre his 80s stuff. So it's very thematic. It's very brooding, but it has this great sensuality to it as well, which is what the movie needed, I think. I think this movie without the soundtrack, I think, would not be very good, really. Also, I have to say, I found out in research, I ended up watching the director's cut.
Oh, I didn't know there was a different version.
Well, the one that he bleached, essentially. The one that he desaturated.
I thought they all were that way, because mine looked kind of faded, too.
Well, then you watched his... Basically, I found out, this is kind of, you know, segueing into production or whatever, but found out that after it was released, he really wanted originally it to be shot in black and white. He thought it would be a great homage to the original, and he wanted to do that and thought it would be really cool. He actually even worked on his lighting being a very, very stark look, so it would look almost black and white. When he finally got his final cut of it and his approval after the release, so it was released, pretty big hit, did okay, you know, that sort of thing. But when he got it for, the rights were returned to him, I think somehow I read, for VHS release and then eventually in DVD, he desaturated it all. He pulled almost all of the color out of it. So occasionally you'll see some reds in the faces, but basically everything is very grays and tones of gray and everything. Whereas if you look at that compared to the original print that was released, I mean, the skies are bright blue and there's lots of color. I mean, dynamic colors, almost like Hammer. But he didn't want that, and that was one of the reasons. He wanted to be an homage to 31 and people to make sure it was not a Hammer movie. So he didn't want that blood red and those big colors and all of that.
Which is funny because, like you said, without the music, I think it would play like a Hammer film.
I think it would too, totally. It is so pretentious in places with this, you know. So the only big color element he left in the desaturated version was that, oh, let's play with a laser sex scene. That's really the only version, the only section that's really colorful. All the red and the you know, the silhouettes and all of that. So that's the version I watched. And then I watched a documentary on the making of it, and a lot of it compared the original to this. And I thought it was very interesting to see the comparison. I would love to see the color again. And they supposedly, the new Blu-ray has both versions.
Both.
So you can watch the color restoration.
Interesting.
Enough about that.
You already mentioned how much you liked it, and I'm assuming you saw it at the theater.
Yeah, I saw it at the theater, then ended up buying the album so I could hear the music, and then, of course, getting the VHS. So I watched it over. I liked it because I really do like – it's ironic because I don't like Twilight, but I do like this thing of the vampire being a somewhat sexy character. A very sensual character that then you get pulled into it and realize, oh, no, now I'm undead, you know, sort of thing. As opposed to the straight monster in Hammer or a lot of the other remakes and everything else are the creature features where he's a ghoul or that sort of thing. I like that count aristocracy, and now I'm going to bite you on your neck, you know, sort of thing.
Well, see, I like, and I've had this discussion with you in the past.
Oh, yeah.
I like both versions. I like romantic type vampires, and I like savage vampires.
Right.
And I have a little bit of a problem with Dracula being the romantic Dracula because it was not written that way.
Yes.
Anne Rice's book was written that way, and they play it that way. Dracula was really never meant to be a romance, per se.
Well, I go back and forth, especially since this is our second double feature episode, and both of these are heavily influenced by romance.
Right.
I think that's what was missing from the novel, is a romantic element. I think what happens in the Coppola version, where they add that, it really does improve the story, in my opinion. But yes, to your point, if you're a purist on the novel, Dracula's a monster. He really is right. a bad guy from the very beginning. You know, he's feeding babies to the brides and he's, killing people and doing all that. The romantic, he's not romantic at all.
Yeah. My first memory of this movie is watching it on VHS, I believe at Tim Larson's house.
Okay.
And I did not like it, but it was 1980 something. And I was in the midst of, horror movie mania and watching slasher films and zombie films. And I was bored. It just kind of bored me. Now, going back and rewatching it for maybe even the first time, I think this was just the second time I had seen it.
Wow.
I like it much more. Mainly not because of Frank Langella, but because of Donald Pleasance and Laurence Olivier, who are clearly having a lot of fun while they're doing this movie. And you're talking about two really strong actors, especially Olivier, who could phone it in really if he wanted to.
Well, and he kind of did in this. I mean, in reading about it. He was very frail at this time. He actually had a disease almost like, what do you call it when you cut somebody and you, they bleed really bad?
Anemic?
No, anemic is low blood, but,
it's like when you're on blood thinners or on.
Right. Right.
Like cholesterol medicine, you just bleed a lot. Your blood's thinner.
He was suffering from a condition that did that. Even the smallest nick, he would bleed for hours. And they had to be like even careful, like attaching his wig or detaching his wig because they would tear the skin and he would just start bleeding. So he was very frail at the time. I read one interview where, even Langella was thinking he didn't even know if he would make it through the movie, filming the movie. So that's why they changed up a lot of the action sequences and gave them more to Harker. That's why there's not as much of a physicality to Van Helsing in this one. But again, just watching Laurence Olivier and watching Donald Pleasance, they could read the phone book and be interesting. I mean, they are just amazing.
Right. You know? And I read that, well, and I may have to get into this when we get into casting, because we'll definitely get into casting. But I had read that Donald Pleasance had been offered Van Helsing, and he turned it down because of Halloween. He said it was too similar to Sam Loomis.
Makes sense.
Dr. Loomis.
Makes sense.
So,
Production-wise, I think it was – this was 48 years after the original Dracula. Mm-hmm. Again, it was based on the play. But they also went back to the novel to give it some portions that were missing from the play, namely, the whole ship thing, which you can't do in a play, of course, and some other stuff. Albert Whitlock did the matte paintings for it. So that's this guy that we mentioned before has done The Thing. He did Star Trek, the motion picture, that sort of thing.
He's fantastic.
Yes. Yeah. And some of the design looks great. The castles look great. All of his matte work works. This was actually shot in England. It was actually shot at Shepperton Studios, which gave us stuff like Alien, 2001, Star Wars, Blade Runner. All of those came from the same studio. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was very interesting for just production values. John Badham directed, I remembered John Badham from War Games, and it's very interesting.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah, okay. I didn't know this in researching, and I found out he went on to do Psych, the TV show. The TV show with the black guy and the white guy?
Tony Shalhoub.
No, Tony Shalhoub's in I can't remember his name. It's just his character name is the name of it, like Columbo. It's him.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Sorry. But I didn't mean to just derail you.
That's okay. Psych is the one with the two criminal investigators, both young. One's a black guy, one's a white guy, and they're a buddy comedy kind of trio. Duo. It's really funny.
Monk.
It was Tony Shalhoub. Yes.
It was Tony Shalhoub. Yeah.
But I watched Psych forever when it was on cable and everything and syndication. And now I find out that this guy who did Dracula also did like 5 years of Psych.
I was trying to remember what Badham did. And then I thought, oh, War Games.
Oh, yeah. You know,
Ali Sheedy, Matthew Broderick. I remember going, I think I saw that at the theater with you.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure we did.
He also did Rush Hour, the comedy as well.
Okay.
So, I mean, he was mostly a comedy guy, which is interesting because this movie doesn't have any levity to it. There is even the little, I never drink wine is not played as a joke. It's played as a mystery thing. And right. So there's not a lot of humor in this anywhere in this particular film.
No, I mean, I found humor in watching Donald Pleasance, but I always find humor in watching Donald Pleasance.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What about favorite scenes? Did you have any favorite scenes?
Well, first of all, when she goes to, is it Carfax Abbey in this one where he lives?
He lives in Carfax Abbey in all of them. So far, all four.
Okay.
Not the Hammer one, but the other three.
I love the set. I think the set is great.
Oh, yeah.
Production design? The one where the set looks like it's got a bat face in the center of it.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
I was like, is that a bat face? I couldn't really tell. I was like, that is a really crazy looking set. So anything in his house or his place of lodging was fascinating to me.
Yes.
And then the asylum itself, I thought looked really cool as well.
Yeah, the way they designed it, it's interesting. That's my number two favorite scene is production design of Carfax Abbey. So interesting that we think it was brilliant. I love the candles, the way they did all the candles and the candelabras and everything else. It was really cool.
It's not clean like you would expect it to be. It looks like Dracula's castle did in 1931's version.
Oh, yeah. With the spider.
It's very dusty and dirty and cobwebby and just creepy.
Even her arrival when she's there and suddenly it cuts to that overhead shot and it's through a spider web and we see a spider crawling and she's in the foreground, you know, in the distance and everything. It was really, that design, I agree with you. I think that design really, all the production design, the boat itself feels like a real boat when they are aboard it and everything else. Both boats, the Demeter, in the beginning and then the one, that crack us to take to get back wherever. I mean, it got really bad in that third act. It got really, did not make sense to me at all.
Is that the one where they showed the map? Or no, that's actually Bram Stoker's.
That's Bram Stoker's.
That's Coppola.
Well, because, you know, we talked about it last week, but the original novel, and I thought about it when I was watching this one, it suddenly occurred to me, a key for me is Dracula, the novel. Not the, any of the movies really, but the novel was the original found footage of novels.
Oh, yeah. It's epistolary. It's like written in diary journals or entries.
Correct.
Isn't it?
It's all done with like Harker's journal and then Mina's journal and then the captain's log of the Demeter and then the travel log of the train conductor. And so it's all of these little,
snippets
tied together to tell the story. So naturally, Carrie, you don't have
Stephen King does that with Carrie too.
Yeah, but he's still got a third person POV in that, and you don't really have that in Dracula. It's all different perspectives, which we talked about last week. That's why it's a struggle to tell a cohesive story with this plot because our protagonist changes. You know, the whole first part of the novel. Way too long, in my opinion, in the novel, is with Jonathan Harker. And then suddenly he disappears. And now suddenly we have to watch Mina and Lucy and all the suitors and meet Seward and then meet Van Helsing, who's not even into like halfway through the frickin' novel. And and all of this is, it's hard to figure out who's the hero, who's not.
Right.
And then it gets more convoluted when you suddenly make, essentially like this one does in 79, Dracula's essentially your hero. He's the one we're following the entire freaking play or movie. And, you know, I guarantee we are supposed to feel sorry for him at the end.
Yeah. And we don't have all the suitors in this one either.
No.
There's no Quincy or, who else? The Seward guy. Well, I mean, technically you've got Donald Pleasance, but he's not a suitor.
No. In the novel, like in Bram Stoker's, you have the three suitors. You have Quincy Morris. You have the rich guy. I cannot remember his name right now that Cary Elwes plays. And you've got Elwes plays.
Lord Arthur Holmwood.
Yeah. Arthur Holmwood and Seward. The young Seward.
Right. Jack Seward.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now the play makes Jack Seward an older contemporary of Van Helsing. That's why he calls him, because they're old friends.
Right.
So he doesn't become a suitor anymore because he's an old man now. And that's the way the play is. And that's the way the 31 version was. And that's the way this version in 79 is he's really an older guy, who's the father of, wait, they switched the girls in this one. Father of Mina. Yeah. No.
Yeah. It's Mina Van Helsing. Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, so father of Lucy, right? Yes, no.
No. He calls Laurence Olivier's version of Van Helsing because it is Mina's, because he is Mina's father.
Right, Mina Van Helsing, who dies
I kept thinking Wilhelmina sounds like a Dutch name, Wilhelmina Van Helsing.
Right, and so she plays Mina, and she... But Kate Nelligan is Lucy, and Lucy is Dracula love interest.
Right.
Yes.
Right. There she is behind me now.
Yeah.
And I think she's great. And I kept saying, I know her. What do I know her from? Because she looks so familiar to me.
And what did you know her from?
I don't know that I ever looked. I think I did, and I didn't remember her from anything.
I asked because I did the same thing. I thought, I've seen her in a bunch of stuff. And I looked her up and go, nope, not seen any of that. I don't know where I saw her.
No, I hadn't either. That's so funny that I'm glad you tricked me.
No, I did the exact same thing.
Tricked me because I couldn't find anything that I remembered her from. But I was like, I remember her. She must look like somebody else.
Well, she did really good. I do like the fact that
she looks a little bit like Eleanor Donahue.
Well, since we can't show fangs and evil blood and mean stuff on Dracula, we'll do it on all the girls. And both of them are awesome. Yeah. They look really good when they're possessed or when they're
vamped out.
Vamped out, which they obviously can change instantaneously. we won't get into that whole thing, but there's that. Yes.
Let's see.
But I was saying favorite scenes. I agree with you about production design. Mine were the Mina killing when we finally kill. Or yes, it's Mina Murray when we finally kill her. I liked that scene. I really liked the Van Helsing Dracula scene. The one that's taken from the play, taken from the 31 version. The whole "I see you in the mirror." The one that ends with him literally in front of us turning into a wolf and diving out the window. Mm-hmm. That scene between the two of them, and you could tell Langella and Olivier both had a ball doing that scene. It was just very adversarial. It was really cool the way they blocked it. So I really like that. And then I put not a favorite scene, but you cannot watch this movie and not mention the love scene because it sticks out like a big red laser lit sore thumb for no reason. Why is it even in there? And the music sounds.
Is that the one that's all Ken Russell with all imagery and stuff? Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy.
And my key is, okay, they filmed this at Shepperton Studio, right? That scene is lit by a laser behind them. That's why they're in silhouette laying on the bed or hanging or whatever with this red laser going through them with all the smoke. That laser is the one that the Who had, and they kept renting it out to production companies. Oh, like that little one with the science fiction theme called Alien that had the plane laser when John Hurt is down in the egg chamber. That's the same laser. It's the same laser that they're using. And so it's a big, big production tie-in key for me. But yeah, you cannot, I mean, it just comes from nowhere in this movie. And I'm going, what? I don't understand what's happening. We suddenly got into a Ken Russell movie. And
yeah, it's very strange. And that is a good segue to a little bit of trivia that I have with Mr. Russell. Apparently, Ken Russell was also planning a version at the same time of Dracula. And at one stage, he had envisioned Laurence Olivier as the Count I was thinking he'd be a little old. He later was going to cast Peter O'Toole or Mick Fleetwood, which he's not an actor, but he is very tall and very gaunt looking.
Yeah.
From Fleetwood Mac, in the lead. And he also considered Peter Ustinov as Van Helsing, and he wanted Oliver Reed as Renfield, which I love because
that would be
Ken Russell did. Yeah. I mean, Ken Russell did a few movies with Oliver Reed, if I'm not mistaken. Definitely one that I can think of. And then Sarah Miles and Mia Farrow as Lucy and Mina.
Ooh.
And then, wait. And Michael York and James Coburn were also on his wish list. Can you imagine this movie if it had been made?
Wow.
Ken Russell's Dracula with that cast. That's crazy.
That's crazy. That would be crazy.
So instead we get a little Ken Russell montage in this movie.
Uh-huh.
Basically. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, but any other things you want to point out before we move on to casting?
I liked some of the attempts in this to, for the scares or for the creepiness or whatever. Like I liked, you know, having Dracula appear just from the mist when they're in the crypt. That was neat. I like the way he just kind of appeared in the background, trying to do the straight transformations of turning into a wolf or a bat or whatever. Like the first time he, you know, he attacks Renfield and he swoops down from the top and literally changes it to a bat in midair. I thought that was kind of cool. I did kind of question, why are all vampires in all of these movies telekinetic? How come they never open doors themselves? The door is always open for them and closed behind them and do all that. Since when was a vampire ever telekinetic? I don't understand. In this one, he's very hypnotic, literally hypnotizing.
They're telekinetic in Anne Rice's latter books, for sure.
Really?
But not in Dracula. No. Mm-mm.
Yeah. And I never got the whole, I don't understand why they're telekinetic. We'll get into
And I may be thinking telepathic. Like they could read thoughts. I don't know if they actually could make things move. I don't think so.
No, but they do in all of these, you know, even Lugosi never touched the door. The door's open for him or whatever. And then they got really lost in this, in my opinion, in the last third of it with how the whole thing works. I mean, like, you can be afraid of a cross and it burn you, but then you can kiss it. Or I don't know. How do people change so quick? Is she a vampire? Isn't she? Because she's certainly acting like one, but then she's not. And it got really lost to me.
I have problems with those things in most Dracula and vampire movies. One is, you know, do crosses work? Do they not? Garlic, holy water, whatever. The whole, can he come in or does he have to be invited? Because sometimes they have to invite him, but then all of a sudden he walks into another place and you're like, wait, what? And so that's another one. And then lastly, it lost me. I can't remember, but there's always inconsistencies with that. Almost in every film, it seems like to me. So I often wonder.
Well, I think it's fine. You know, Anne Rice did a great job of, I'm going to play with the ones I like and drop the ones I don't kind of thing. I think Buffy the Vampire Slayer was the same way. It was like, we're keeping these, we're getting rid of these. And as long as you keep it real in your world, I think that's
you
fine.
You just need context.
What I agree with you on, and I don't like in both of these versions today, is what's the whole deal with the cross? Either it's going to repel or it's not. But if it repels, then okay, but then you can set it on fire or you can suddenly kiss a crucifix or it burns you, but then it doesn't burn you and you can wear it around your neck. So figure it out, get it right, and just do it.
I mean, Stephen King did it in that stupid Salem's Lot we watched last Christmas with basically it only works if you have faith. So then it makes sense, you know.
That one worked for me and scared me and loved it. But, you know, and the whole tie-in to the church in Bram Stoker's version makes a lot of sense with the cross and everything else. In this one, they try to go back to the original novel, which is saying this guy is cursed. He is a demon. Things of holy tradition would repel him. So holy water, the wafer, the cross, all of that. But they don't repel him. As a matter of fact, he melts a cross, he burns another one, and then you put the wafers in his coffin. It's like, what good's that going to do? Obviously, crosses don't work. You right. know, so anyway. So I do think
sometimes, like I said, I get them confused, but in some cases they were using communion wafers and sticking them in the dirt.
Right. That's what I mean. The wafers, and does it work? Does it not? Don't know. And I'm really, the makeup was really inconsistent. I loved the fangs and the red eyes. I think that was an homage to like Hammer and everything else. Mm-hmm. But then all the regular makeup, like for cuts or for the bites on the neck or Jonathan's cuts on his face, are terrible. Just terrible yeah. makeup. It's like really
like
bad.
Wax.
Yeah. I was going, oh my God, that is terrible.
It's like, come on, Batum.
Come on, Batum. Let's get it right. Okay, casting. Sorry. I'll shut up.
Oh, that's okay. I was just going to move on to cast. We mentioned Frank Langella, who plays the lead. I did not know much about him. He was a stage actor. Obviously, a good one. He was nominated for a Tony for this role. The only thing I really knew him for is that he dated Whoopi Goldberg for like 5 years. they were live-in partners for a good while.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. 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 They lived together for at least 5 years. I even looked it up, but I just remember that they were partners for a while. But anyway, it's like you said, he would not play him as a ghoul. He wanted him to be romantic, no teeth, no blood. And he basically said that he portrayed him on stage as a unique and distinctive, having a unique and distinctive social problem. And that is that he has to have blood to live because he is immortal. And that's it. He didn't like the whole monster aspect. And of course, that is downplayed in the play anyway, correct?
Well, no. Van Helsing basically calls him the undead, the Nosferatu, you know, a demon. So it's there, but it's the play is a collection of how do we get to the next cool special effect? You know, how do we turn him into a bat on stage kind of thing, which they do, which is good. You know, I think Langella overly played the romanticism, and I think the good balance is struck in the Bram Stoker one.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem I have with both these movies is the romance. I know that you like it, but I don't.
So, yeah, but he looked cool. He looked cool climbing down the wall. That was pretty scary.
He does look cool, but that's not anything to do with romance.
True.
We mentioned Laurence Olivier. You mentioned his medical condition, so I won't go back into that. Mm-hmm. But I will say, and this is a bit of a key, the fact that they brought Laurence Olivier in to play this part had a unique impact on the horror movie genre, or horror movies in the genre in particular. It was the beginning of let's bring old school actors in and revitalize the genre somewhat. And the biggest example that came out shortly after, like 2 years later, was Ghost Story.
Oh.
The Peter Straub novel that had a cast including Fred Astaire, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., Melvin Douglas, and John Houseman. All old school.
Man,
Hollywood.
That'd be cool to revisit because I loved that novel. And I remember thinking
it's on the list now.
thinking the movie was a hit and miss, but I really liked
it. The movie was not that good.
That novel a lot.
Right. But it's on our list.
Oh, really? So, okay.
Yeah, it is now.
It is now.
Donald Pleasance was offered the role, as I said, of Van Helsing. He turned it down because he thought it was too similar to Loomis, who he had just played in Halloween the year prior. But he was buds with Laurence Olivier and said that he one of his quotes is, "I've only done one Dracula, that very expensive one with Frank Langella, and Lord Laurence Olivier and I were the doctor and the professor. We had a really good time. It was an awful film, but we did it for a laugh."
It was an awful film.
Great. It was an awful film, but we did it for a laugh. But one thing I learned that I did not know about him, and this fascinates me. He's what's known as a props actor. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard this?
Yes. I had not heard it about him in particular, but I was aware of the term when I read it. Yes.
But it's not, I mean, when I think of a props actor, I think of like, you, when you're on stage, you want things to do that make it, make you feel like you're more in the character. The reason he used props was because he knew it made it more difficult to edit him out of scene.
Correct.
Because of continuity.
Yes.
So he was always fiddling with something in order to not be cut from the film and have more screen time.
Yes.
Which I had never heard of that, but I find it fascinating.
I had heard of it before, never in relation to him. There are other people that are like that. I think it stands out kind of glaringly in this film, which is why it's brought up in several reviews and people talking about it and everything, because literally every scene, he's either eating something or holding something, even if it's a candy. But if he is sitting on the carriage and he's just supposed to sit there and say your freaking lines, Donald, he takes out a candy, unwraps it, eats it, and then he's talking with it the whole time, you know. And so they can't cut around that. We can't cut to another scene. You, what do you, why? Yeah.
That's so hilarious to me.
I totally very, understand it.
Very shrewd.
Shrewd,
on his
yeah.
Part.
Yeah. I'm sure the editors were screaming, you know, the entire time.
I'm sure. Yeah. I am sure. And then the only other thing I have about him is that he was so notorious for being a scene stealer that Frank Langella was actually warned, watch out when you're on stage with Donald Pleasance or on screen with Donald Pleasance. He will steal the scene from you.
Makes so, sense.
Much fun to watch. I don't have any more in depth on the rest of the cast, but I will say that, like we said, Lucy was played by Kate Nelligan, who is very familiar to me, even though I don't know what I know her from. Jonathan Harker was played by Trevor Eve. Some of these are British actors. Like you said, it was filmed in England. Mina was played by Jan Francis. Annie Janine Duvitsky and Milo Renfield was played by Tony Haygarth. I think they all must be British actors because I do not know who those people are.
Yeah, and looking at research, both Kate Nettleton and the guy that played Harker went on to do a bunch of British television.
Kate Nelligan.
Yes. Kate Nelligan okay. And the guy.
You said that, Middleton.
Oh, sorry. That's the, okay. She's the princess. But Kate and the guy that played Harker went on to do a bunch of British television. So they're makes very sense. Well known in England. I also, speaking of casting and talking about it, I also felt very kind of jilted this time because we watched this so close to the Hammer one and comparing Peter Cushing's Van Helsing, which is so good, to Laurence Olivier's was really bad in my opinion. I mean, it was like, ooh. I mean, because Cushing is so memorable and so, like you said, physical. I mean, he runs and jumps and grabs that curtain and tears it down and he holds the candlesticks up as a cross and all that. And this Van Helsing is like, would you mind please handing me the hammer? Thank you.
I totally agree. I think out of all four of these movies, I will go ahead and say that Peter Cushing is the best Van Helsing.
Oh, no.
I don't like Anthony Hopkins as Anthony Hopkins irritates me.
You better shut up now because we're going, okay, we'll get into that then, obviously. We'll get into it.
But he just come off Silence of the Lambs and he you talk about scene stealer. He was the Donald Pleasance of Francis Ford Coppola's.
He should be. He's Van Helsing. And face it, not hard to steal a scene if you're in it with Keanu Suck Reeves. You know.
Well, no. Well, that's true. But he also had several others with him. Anyway,
true.
He's a ham in that movie, man. A big ham. awards. This movie won. It was not nominated for hardly anything, but since we do have friends over at the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films, the Saturn Awards, it did win Best Horror Film of 1980. Well, it would have been 1979, but the awards were in 1980.
Yeah, really?
It did. But I guess there wasn't a lot out.
There were no other horror movies.
Alien... Alien came out, but I don't know if they considered that sci-fi. They probably considered that sci-fi.
It was a lot scarier than this.
It was a lot scarier.
It's so funny looking at my notes, and I've got near the bottom here. Okay, Tim will hate this. This is a little too much romance and not enough horror, I'll just tell you.
Well, This was also nominated for Best Actor, Langella, Supporting Actor, Donald Pleasance, Director, Badham, and Makeup, Peter Rob King. And you just was ridiculing his makeup. How dare you?
Yeah. His second unit bite, it was not good.
But I will say, of all the Draculas we've covered, 1931, 58, this one, and 1992, this is the only one that is not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die list.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's not. But guess what is that came out the very same year?
What?
Nosferatu with Klaus Kinski.
Oh, God. See?
we talked about this
last
year.
We talked about it.
Because that movie's terrible.
Yes.
And it's on the 1001 list.
No, I mean, this movie should be on the 1001 just for the soundtrack. It's phenomenal.
It should be on it above Nosferatu. But in all honesty, I don't really think either one should be on there. So
agreed. I mean, I would totally agree with you. But in comparison, I would pick this one long before that one. Sort of thing. I mean, again, look, that even that picture you've got, the girls, the women in this are genuinely scary when they vamp out.
I think they are too.
Yeah. And it works for me even as much as the, even better than Brides of Dracula, which we talked about last week, which I think, you know, the girls in that are very scary as well. The women in that.
But look behind me, if you're on YouTube, at the pictures. We have the really scary picture, and then we have the romance picture where they're like, it's like a romance novel cover.
Oh, it is. Totally.
Laying on the leaves in what looks like daylight. Which would confuse the fuck out of them. That's the other thing. That was the other thing I was going to mention.
Oh, the other convention
whether
of vampirism?
They can come out in the daylight or not. I do not like that either. But anyway, so if I had to pick between those two pictures behind me, of course I'm going to pick the scary one, man. That romantic one sucks.
Well, yeah, and I'm the same way, even down to that cape being a deep blue, not a black cape, so that it has all that velvety reflection look to it. Mm. And to your point about the sunlight, I remember the first time watching this and he suddenly gallops up with that horse and I'm going, what? The sun is still out. How is he? And then in the very next scene, he says, you know, I only have to stay in the shadows. I can be awake at night. I just have to stay in the shadows. I went, no, you can't. But no, uh-uh. No. It's a big deal.
We say nay.
Nay. Nay.
That is not happening. That is a given. You can get rid of the garlic, the crucifixes, the holy water, but the day and night thing stays. That is like sacrosanct as far as I'm concerned.
And then I've got, let's see, my last final things before keys, I guess, are I did like the whole let's dig up the grave and find out she actually dug out of it into the mines. I thought that was a good, creepy scene. And the way Van Helsing went down there by himself, Donald still has to eat some more food up here, but Van Helsing went in by himself. And then the way he saw
her. But Donald, Seward still goes down and helps him.
Yes.
So he does follow him eventually.
Eventually. Yeah. When he finishes his
snack. I'll be there in just a minute. Let me eat this last payday.
toffee or whatever. And then the way they did the first time he sees, in this version, it's Mina. First time he sees her is in the reflection in the water. And then it pans up to show her all zombed out and ugly and, you know, and she's coming toward him. I love that. I thought, okay, now we're in a scary movie.
But you wouldn't see her reflection, would you?
See, that was my point. That's what I was getting to.
Very Medusa-esque, though. Yeah. I'll give you that. Very classic Greek mythology. Yeah.
And then they throw in this. I know why he did it, because Richter said in an interview that, you know, a problem with the book is the last part of the book is this huge chase across Europe. Because it was almost like a travelogue kind of thing. And how do you put that into a movie?
Well, if you're Francis Ford Coppola, you show a map with little
dots.
That's
right, the way you should. but in 79, instead they show this car chase, which is one of the most boring car chases I've ever seen. It is just terrible. But they love that car. That car is in 60% of this movie. I think they must have gotten that car from somebody who co-sponsored this movie and said, hey, it's got to be in almost every scene.
I think it's the only movie of the Draculas that we see with a car, isn't it? Or is there one in the Coppola in the streets? I can't remember.
Mm, No, they're in carriages because it's 1912 okay. or 1913, I think, in Coppola. But yeah, this whole car chase through, you know, and I'm saying, okay, the car cannot catch that one carriage, really? And just, it didn't work. I know why they did it, but it didn't play up for me. And then I have to say,
it reminded me of Terrence Fisher, that run with the, or that, that devil movie we watched last year where they're riding around in that car all the time.
Yeah. And he ends up breaking the windshield or frosting over the windshield or whatever during the chase.
Yeah, exactly.
I got that one too. And then
Devil Rides Out was the name of it. Yeah.
We can't go on without mentioning that, that's like you can buy that, I think, from Amazon, the, Dracula kite kit that's at the very end of this that makes no sense, that they did obviously to set up a sequel, I guess, or something.
They did. And they actually kill Van Helsing specifically because Laurence Olivier said, "You have to kill me. I'm not coming back."
Yeah. He did a Han Solo, Harrison Ford that. And yeah, said, "Kill me. Said, I'm not doing
a sequel."
and then, yeah, so they do that whole kind of pseudo battle scene, gets hooked, comes up, dies way too long in the sunlight, I much preferred the Hammer version where he just dusted really quick. That was cool.
Or his ankle melts. That was
ankle
cool.
melts first. Yeah. Yeah. But then he turns into this obvious, very bad black kite, flying away. But I did get a key out of that, which is the one where the cape blew off at the end, Midnight Mass that we watched this year. You know, because at the very end of that, the cape flies off.
You're right.
And I thought, I wonder if they did that because of this. I wonder if Flanagan said, I'll show you how to do it. Right.
It was that vampire creature with the wings, with the holes in it.
Right. But he flew off at the end. I was wondering, I wonder if that was him saying, see, I'll show you how to do it right. Which is,
it may have been.
But yeah, it was, they wanted to have this whole, I do like the element of treating, you know, again, Yul and I disagree, but I do like the element of treating Dracula as a tortured soul. If he doesn't really enjoy this lifestyle, he's been cursed by it and has to do it. Much more so in this version than even in the Coppola one. Because he even says in this one, instead of Children of the Night, what beautiful music, he says sad music in this version.
He does. And I don't even recall that.
Yeah. And he talks about how it's condemned. He feels condemned by this life. And that's played up a lot more in the Coppola version, but I do kind of like
that. I'm
okay
with the tortured soul. I honestly think the Wolfman does it better. As far as having, you know, a curse and
much better.
You not wanting it. It's just the romance. I'm over it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we're going to have a lot of trouble going to the next one.
Oh, I know. And let's go because we can come back to keys.
Okay.
For all of them at the end, like we did last week. All right. So the next movie, is, as David said, closest to the novel.
Darn right it is. Yep.
However, there is one major thing they added, which is the whole Vlad Tepes legend.
The prologue.
Vlad the Impaler was a real historical figure. That was a Romanian tyrant, or maybe not a tyrant, but he was definitely a warmonger that killed millions of people. or I guess if you look at it in the day, it would may have been thousands of people.
Yeah.
That, ironically enough, is not the first Dracula movie to do that. They lifted that from our buddy Dan Curtis and Jack Palance, who first added that myth in there. And it's not really a myth. I mean, Vlad's last name or his family name was Dracul. It's Dracula without the A. So to link those two figures together, I don't have a problem with that as much as I do the romance. So,
no, I thought it was an incredibly good add. The prologue works for me really well. I think it sets it up. It is taking from the more modern elevated lore of Dracul being dragon in Romanian and the order of the Dracul, which was supposedly this what Vlad Tepes was a member of. And they did fight the Turks. They were, you know, this Walekian lord He just went a little crazy. It's almost like, who's the lady in the Bathory, Madame Bathory, who always, you know, bathed in virgin blood? And that was another thing.
Oh, because it would keep her young or something. Yeah.
And she would have all of these, you know, she would get all these young girls from the village to come work in her castle, and then they would never come home because she was bathing in their blood, supposedly. And that whole legend around her was similar to the legend around Vlad, which is he would take his enemies, he would literally impale them in his courtyard and then have banquets served with their bodies hanging there and everything, because he was that, quote, bloodthirsty. And that kind of has just added to this vampire mythology over the decades. I think it gives it a really strong backstory to this. I also think it's a very scary but moving, emotional prologue and opening to this. It definitely sets up, again, Dracula as probably the protagonist to this story. We are telling his story, not Mina's, not Lucy's, not Van Helsing's. We are telling his story. Now, is he, quote, an anti-hero in this? Sort of, yeah. Because he is a bad guy. But in this, they're trying to romanticize him into saying he's a bad guy for right reasons. You know, he made the mistake of cursing himself by turning against the cross and the church. Yada, yada.
So, yeah, in his little rebellious scene at his love's death at the beginning.
Yeah, and if you...
What was her name? I can't even remember.
Elisabetta.
Elisabetta.
Yes. That's one of my favorite elements of this, actually, is that backstory and the creation of him becoming a vampire. Because we never learn in the novel how he became a vampire. We never learn in the movies how he became a vampire. And this is definitely says, this is how this happened to him. He fought for the church for years in the Crusades. His wife dies and they say she can't get a Christian burial. She's doomed to hell because she took her own life. And he goes, screw your church, you, your God, all of that.
I will stab your giant crucifix and fill this place up with blood.
Which looks great. I love it pouring out of it and on the floor.
Yeah,
and everything.
It's pretty bloody.
Awesome. Yeah, it's a really, this is a good bloody version of Dracula, I think.
It's, I've read somewhere where it's considered Coppola's last great movie.
I'd agree.
Lumped it in with like Godfather and something else.
Well, cinematography's great. Costume design's great. Production design's great. The blood all works except for one shot when it goes into the vial during the transfusion. It looks terrible. It looks like syrup. But the blood in almost every other scene looks really, really good. And you know how I'm a stickler on good looking blood.
I do like the way the screenplay is set up. I like the way it is written as far as flow. I enough so that I looked the guy up, and he really hasn't done a lot of great stuff.
James Hart.
He did Hook.
Yeah.
And he did one of the Muppet movies, Treasure Island.
Yep. He also did a version of Frankenstein, which is really good, screenplay-wise. And again, in watching an interview with him, it was basically his idea to – with working with Coppola to give this backstory to it and to give this humanization to.
He also did Contact, which may or may not be one of the movies we're covering this season.
Jodie Foster?
Yeah.
Oh, based on Carl Sagan's book. Yeah. I didn't know he did that version. That'll be interesting.
I just happened to catch that. So anyway, we may have a double screenplay there going.
But he went back to source material like Coppola always does. He likes to go to the novel as a source material. And so Hart definitely takes a lot of this from the novel. The structure of this is almost exactly like the novel. Mm-hmm. It starts out with Jonathan. Then we cut to London. We cut back to Jonathan. What's happening to him? We cut back to London. Jonathan escapes. Now we're back in London. And then we have the whole Lucy thing. And then we have the whole Carfax, you know, the team forms to fight him, but he's going back to Romania and we've got to go back there and fight him there on his own home turf.
Yeah. That's when it gets a little superhero.
That's in the novel. So I kind of gave it to him. I went, you know, didn't really work in the book either. So I give it to you.
Do you have any other production stuff before we move on to scenes?
I think we have to – all of the production staff for this I think are incredible. Dante Ferretti did all the production design, and I really like that. And he, I have to credit, because Coppola, up until, I think I remember this correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, if you guys know it better than me, but I think I remember seeing that Coppola, up until like 3 weeks before the first shot was filmed, didn't want any full sets. He wanted minimal sets. He wanted the entire focus to be on costuming.
I read that. He was looking to do a really abstract version where the actors were not going to be on sets.
And Columbia.
And there are elements in this movie where you see that.
Yes, too. Where he's only doing two walls or whatever.
Right.
But Columbia said, no, you're doing freaking a set.
It's a movie. It's a movie. It is not an art project.
Right. So he hired, Dante Ferretti, and Dante Ferretti's a genius. I loved his design work in this. I liked the way he did, especially Dracula's Romanian castle, because he did both the interiors and the exteriors. So the exterior of that is his. The asylum design is really good again in this. Carfax Abbey, not as much, but we don't spend a lot of time there in this one. So it's not as important. But I really think, and I think she won the Academy Award for it, but, Aiko Ishihiko, I think is her last name, but she did the costume, all the costuming design.
Costumes are great.
And the costumes are brilliant and so influenced.
I'm torn with this movie because there are parts of this movie I really like, but there are parts of this movie I really don't like. One of the things I admire the most about it is that it is all practical effects. There is, like, I think one digitized effect in this entire movie, and I can't even remember what that is.
The blue hoops.
Oh yeah, the weird fire, and it wasn't even that good.
No,
but all the things you see watching it in modern time in 2022, it looks like the old school effects of a movie that was made, you know, by Universal. I mean, they're really cool effects that made me feel nostalgic for the old. Within the new, if that makes any sense at all.
And if you like cinematography, even more so, because you realize how he got some of them. Like you talked about the chase scene at the end when they're going through through the mountain pass, the Borga Pass and everything. That was matte paintings, but also that was inside. That was on a sound stage with these horses galloping at full tilt kind of thing.
Right.
That's why some of them he had to do in slow motion because they can't get up to speed in that short space
of
time. They'd be out of frame. But yeah, I love the practical effects. And that was again because of his son Roman, who he gave I think he made him second unit director for this, but he was a magician. So he said, Dad, let's do these as practicals. Mm-hmm. And some people don't even realize it. Like when Jonathan is on the coach and he's reading in his journal and you see superimposed in the window behind him, you see first Mina's eyes and then Dracula's eyes and all that. That was practical. That was a rear screen projection that they shot that on, and it wasn't superimposed later. That was practical.
They do it when Jonathan's on the train too, and you see Dracula's eyes in the clouds.
Yes. Yeah. When in the opening prologue, when he picks up Elizabeth's letter and he's reading it, and then we see her fall in the blood that's on the letter, that was projected onto the piece of paper. Mm-hmm. That Gary Oldman was holding. So those kind of things were really, really cool. And
they were. And some of the transformations were too. Like when he's a bat. I mean, he looks like a human version of a bat. Or when he is a wolf and he's, I guess, raping Lucy on that grave.
Hey, she wanted it. She was dressed that way. Look at her. I mean, you know. Sorry.
But yeah, they had to throw the sex in with the bite, but that's okay. I'll let them do that.
Hey, sex is
so
important.
Yeah, I liked all of the effects and the looks. The production design of this movie is really lush.
Mm-hmm.
Still.
I agree with you. I think the makeup effects work in this. So all the production people, Michael Ballhaus's cinematography, and this guy, again, Wojciech Kilar, is the composer of this music, and I like this music a lot too, almost as much as I like the John Williams score.
Yeah, the music's good. I had no problem with it.
The thematics are good. The leitmotifs are good. You know, Elisabetta and Mina have the same leitmotif that he uses for their scene. Dracula has his own love theme, but he also has a power theme. I mean, it's just really neat the way he ties the music together. I can't do scenes from this because I like them. No, I could. I like them all.
Ooh, I'm stepping on David's movie.
It has a lot of memorable scenes to me, though. I like the Lucy staking. In the 79 version, it's the Mina staking. But I like the Lucy staking, and I like that whole, you know, she just drops that freaking baby.
I love that. That scene sticks out to me immediately. When she comes wandering into the crypt, I'm like, this is very scary. This is kind of vampire I remember as a kid. That's, you know, coming back to its grave. And it has dinner. And then as soon as she sees him, she just drops that baby.
Oh, yeah.
Drops that little kid.
And she does up. And she does the whole...
Yeah.
You know, and the way he intentionally filmed her in reverse getting into the coffin. So it looks really weird and strange the way she backs up and everything. It's really cool and scary.
Yeah. Another thing he does that's similar in this movie that I also like is the way he does all the shadow play, where shadows move not where you expect them to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like he will
and on their
Dracula's
own
shadow on the left when Dracula's actually standing on the right. You're like, wait a minute, why aren't the shadows doing what they're supposed to? And it gives you that sense of insanity or chaos that's going on, you know, that you are not in the norm as far as environment.
And I found out, because, you know, I used to have the big coffee table book of this movie, because I love it so much. But Coppola is actually quoted as saying, one of his precepts of it was, I felt like any time Dracula was present, our normal laws of physics are askew. They don't work. Mm-hmm. So shadows would move on their own. Things would be inverted. Blood drips up. You know, like Jonathan picks up the cologne and the perfume, and it suddenly drips up instead of dripping out of the container. You know, laws of physics don't apply when Dracula's in the scene. And I thought that was a cool precept to have to go with. Mm-hmm. So I've got Lucy staking. The prologue, of course, you already talked to, I thought was brilliant. The absinthe scene I thought was really neat and unique and very along the lines, a perfect alignment with them trying to do the romance, the sexuality, and then the fear and trepidation and something new. You know, basically, because he talks about the green fairy, and, you know, I remember that being a really kind of sensual scene, but also really creepy-esque, uncomfortable. You won't like them, but I like them. Both the scenes between Dracula and Lucy. I mean, Mina. The one at the cinematograph where he actually says the line, the I've crossed oceans of time to find you, and the big scene in the bed, which is so sexy and so romantic and so cool and so neat, but also he gets to turn into a bat at the end of it and looks really cool and then turns into a bunch of rats. So, yeah. Tim, did you have any scenes you like?
I have a scene I don't like.
Okay,
I don't
that?
Like the scene preceding that cinematograph scene or whatever it's called when he's walking around outside
in the daylight. Yep.
With the stupid little purple sunglasses. Just because it's like, here I am, Gary Oldman. I look cool. I'm like, no, you don't. That's stupid.
I thought he looked cool.
He may have the long hairstyle because it's carried over from history and he doesn't know any better. Everyone else obviously has short hair and which makes him stand out, which you would think he wouldn't want to. The fact that he's walking around in the sunlight, but he's protected by these little purple glasses, I guess. I don't know.
No, it didn't make any sense. I don't agree with that with the vampire myth. It didn't work. It should have been a night scene. They should have made it a night scene. It would have made more sense to go to the movies at night too, because they didn't have projectors that were powerful enough at that time. So you'd have to really have a dark room to show these projections. But his costume is awesome. It looks so cool. The top hat, everything looks great.
It's very Interview with the Vampire.
Could be. Yes. Yes. I could see that. I could see her being influenced by that. Yes. So,
and then I also don't like pretty much any scene with Keanu Reeves in it.
Notice I have yet to say his name because we, those of us who love this movie don't want to remember that at all. No. Ever.
And I mean, and Keanu, I don't hate him completely because there are some movies that I like him in. I like The Matrix. But even he says, and I read this somewhere, I don't know if I have it in my notes, that he had just come off of making four films in a row, and he was very tired and not ready to make this movie.
Oh, yeah. He said himself he's not proud of this performance at all, and, and he shouldn't be at all. It sucks so bad. It is such bad casting. From his very first scene to the very end, he is not good in this movie.
No. And it's and the even though I like the scene with him being attacked by the wives of Dracula, there are parts that I don't know, they're just like thrown in there just to be sensational, like when it looks like it's going to be fellatio and then she ends up biting, I guess, his dick. I mean, some of that stuff I'm like, you know, really, did you really want to go there? It was working for me until you went there. You know what I mean?
It worked pretty good for me. That's what I mean. That scene alone is like, since I first saw it, has probably been one of my greatest fantasy sequences ever. That would be, I mean, that just, yes, I would do that in a heartbeat. Sign me up. Right there.
Okay.
I would even be Keanu Reeves for that scene.
Just and then when they come back to him later and he's trying to escape.
Yep.
I was like, that seemed a little out of place to me. But I think it seems out of place in the novel, too.
It does. I mean, there's no way they would have, I think, the self-control without Dracula there to not just drain him dry night one kind of thing. But in the novel, it's the same way. He literally stays there for months being imprisoned by them before he finally escapes. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's practical in the novel. It's not practical here, but that scene where they're just suddenly appearing from the bed and they use Winona's voice. So he thinks it's like Mina sort of thing. Oh,
it's all practical effects again. It's very magician type, illusion.
Yes.
Stuff, which is really cool.
And good and sexy. It's some nice, good and sexy.
Okay.
I'm serious. So, I don't know. It's good.
So if we're moving on from scene, well, I mean, I don't know. Is there any other scenes you want to talk about?
Nope. Dumb scenes.
Okay. I think the Lucy scenes are my favorites when she's a vampire.
She is good.
Yeah.
She's also good when she's not a vampire,
too. She's in that crazy dress with the giant collar and they bury her in that glass coffin, which is creepy as fuck. And then, of course, she comes back to the grave and drops the kid. And then they behead her, which is awesome, too.
There's so much to this movie that is layered for cinephiles. Coppola is so intense in how he mounts a movie and what he does with it and everything else. The making of this, if you can watch the documentary on the making of this, it's really unique. Even down to the point of things the cast didn't like, but he still did, because he took a similar approach to Godfather. You know, he took the entire cast, brought them to Napa Valley, to his ranch, you know, with the Coppola wines or whatever, and for 2 weeks. And for 2 days straight, they read the novel out loud.
Yeah.
And then he had them for another week just play games, like actor games with each other, you know, where you're throwing sound effects at each other, or you're doing improv exercises where you can't say any dialogue, but you have to physicalize your character and all this stuff that Anthony Hopkins thought was total freaking bullshit. He's even said, you know, I just won the Oscar, for God's sake, and you're making me do this. Yeah. But he said in the long run, it did help them solidify those characters and get those characters down to working together and ensembling, which works. And it had worked for Godfather. It obviously works pretty well for this, because except for Keanu, most of the performances are strong. But even then, I say that because you talked about the costuming, There's so much texture and design work that she put into the costuming. Like, you look at Lucy's second costume, where she appears and she's, it's where we meet all the suitors, and she's in, it's like a white costume, but it has like green and blue, like spirals all over her costume. If you look, those are snakes and they're intertwined. And she did that. And the costume designer goes into this whole history about what snakes were like in Victorian England and why she put them into the costume. You know, the design of like Dracula's cloak and the gold dragons that he's got on it are very Germanic dragons from that era. And all, and it's like, oh my God, there's just too much
she
texture.
She won an Oscar for it.
Well, she deserved it. I mean, it was good.
I have a lot on cast.
Yeah.
Gary Oldman, we'll begin with, who obviously played the lead, was, it says he was on his, on Coppola's original list, but there were a lot of people on Coppola's original list, including Daniel Day-Lewis.
Ooh.
Alec Baldwin.
No.
Jason Patrick, Aidan Quinn, Christian Slater, Keanu Reeves. Yeah. Nicolas Cage.
For Dracula?
Nicolas Cage.
Oh, God. See, yes. I interrupted myself. That's so bad.
No, these are all for Dracula. And that's Nicolas Cage, as you know, is Coppola's nephew.
Yeah, well, we saw how well you putting your daughter in Godfather 3 worked. Why would you put
right. Michael Nuri, Dermot Mulroney, Gabriel Byrne.
Ooh, I can see Gabriel Byrne.
Yeah. Costas Mandylor. I don't know who that is.
Oh, yeah. Mandylor. Yeah.
Okay. Nick Cassavetes, Adrian Pazdar, Hugh Grant.
What?
How Rupert many people? Everett, which I could actually maybe see Rupert. Rupert did Barnabas in a remake of Dark Shadows.
Yeah, I could see that.
Ray Liotta, Sting, Kyle MacLachlan, Alan Rickman, maybe.
Oh, it'd be a different take on it.
It would be. Colin Firth and Hart Bochner. Bochner.
Bochner.
Among those who auditioned, see, I'm not through here, were Andy Garcia, who had concerns over the number of sex scenes. Gabriel Byrne, Armand Asante, Antonio Banderas, who I would have loved to have seen his audition tape.
Yeah.
And Viggo Mortensen.
Ooh.
And then
probably,
lastly,
that's probably the best one.
Another person that was considered, you're going to love this, and you know the reason he was considered was just because of what had happened a few years earlier. Michael Keaton was considered as well.
No, 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 no.
Yeah, just wanted to throw those out there for you.
Now, Michael Keaton, maybe he would have made a better Harker than Keanu.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Oh, several people would have made.
So would a goldfish.
Harker.
Yeah.
I mean, you can pretty much go through that whole list. they ended up with obviously Gary Oldman, who has since won an Oscar for his portrayal of Winston Churchill.
Oh, yeah.
He is the second person to play Dracula who has won an Oscar. Do you want to take a guess at who the other person was that ever played Dracula and won an Oscar?
Did he
not
win an Oscar?
Playing Dracula.
Okay.
But in general, an Oscar winner.
An Oscar winner who then went on to play Dracula or played Dracula before?
No, not necessarily. Just an Oscar winning actor that has played Dracula.
I don't know.
Jack Palance.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Hey. Nothing wrong
Although
with
I do want to watch that version. That's the Dan Curtis version you mentioned, right?
It
I haven't
is.
Seen that in a long time. Wasn't that made for television? I haven't seen that in a long time.
It may have. I think it was made for television, and it was. It followed a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde he did with Dan Curtis as well. They did two projects together.
But it's very – it's a little bit truer to the book too from what I remember, vaguely. I haven't
seen it. The sets are terrible though. Because it's, you know, instead of castle, it's like Dark Shadows. It's all wood and paneling.
Oh, okay.
Winona Ryder played Mina.
Yes.
One other person that I have of note was considered for this role, and it was Drew Barrymore.
No.
Yeah, I don't see it. I love Drew. I'm a big Drew Barrymore fan.
I
don't
do too.
See
not
her
this,
doing
role.
This role.
No. Well, however, wait though. Have you seen what's her Cinderella version where she plays Cinderella? Have you seen that? It's really good.
I think I have, but I can't.
She's
remember.
Really good in that and does a British accent and everything. And I think she's good in that.
Is that called Enchanted?
No, it's called Ever After, I think is the name of it.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember if I saw that or not, but I do remember it being.
Because, what's her name? Decent. Plays the fairy, plays the stepmother, evil stepmother, lady who played Morticia in Adam's Family.
Angelica Houston.
Angelica Houston. Yeah. It's a good cast. It's a good movie. Ever After. Okay. But so, yeah, she might have been better for Lucy than Mina. That would have been interesting.
Oh, yeah. I could have easily seen her as Lucy now that you
yes,
mentioned that.
Yes, she could play Lucy a lot. But although Sadie Frost, boy, going to be hard to beat. Man, Sadie Frost was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That
well,
red
I
hair.
I think Winona Ryder's great. I think
I
she's
do too.
Fantastic.
I love
I was Rindus. Really, really impressed. I've always liked Winona Ryder, but then, you know, she kind of had her Margot Kidder moments where she went crazy. And
yep.
I think was a kleptomaniac. Or stole something.
Yep.
Yeah. But I mean, I've always liked Winona. She had a comeback a few years back with Stranger Things. And, but I mean, I've loved her since what? Heathers?
Yep.
It's been a long time. But anyway, she's great in what I would not have cast her in, which is somewhat not Elizabethan, but a Victorian role.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you mentioned all those guys who they considered for Dracula. And I'm wondering how much of that was just in an afternoon, we're throwing around names because it makes sense that somebody goes, well, you already cast Winona. Why don't we put Christian Slater in there? Then they work good together. You know, that sort of thing. You know what I mean? Because
that is how, and I'll get to it, but that is how Keanu Reeves got cast. He only got cast because of his name. Even Francis Ford Coppola says that. Yeah. I just wanted a heartthrob. I didn't care who it was. That's how Keanu. I can read it verbatim. Francis Ford Coppola wanted Johnny Depp to play Jonathan Harker, but the studio wanted someone who was more mainstream, heartthrob. Well, they both were. So, I mean, I don't really see a difference.
I don't think Johnny Depp was in 91. Not yet.
Well, he had already done 21 Jump Street and Nightmare on Elm Street. And he had done Edward Scissorhands.
Oh, was Scissorhands before this?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Okay.
If,
well, then
if
maybe.
Not, it's the same year.
He would have been better for this, although he would have done something worse than Anthony Hopkins to upstage everyone.
Probably.
Because he always does.
Because they're both of the same. Well, I kind of put Johnny Depp more in the Donald Pleasant school of acting.
Yes.
But yeah.
Yes, I would agree with you.
Okay, I didn't mean to jump over to him.
That's okay.
Let's go on to Mr. Hopkins. Mr. Hopkins, who I love and who could read a phone book and who is wonderful in movies like Silence of the Lambs and Magic, drives me insane in this movie. He is overacting so badly.
Now, why do you think that?
I think he's trying to steal scenes. I literally think he is trying to steal scenes.
Is it the scene where he dances with her when he first meets Mina that throws you off?
That's one of them.
Because it's odd. It comes from nowhere, but I think it sets him up as very quirky, which kind of works for me because all we've seen before, his introduction, because I've seen movie probably a dozen times.
It's when he's teaching a class. That's fine.
And he has the joke line, the syphilization.
And
line,
that's great.
You know.
I don't have a problem with that.
His then introduction is smoking a cigar and appearing like the Exorcist, which I think was a Coppola choice and not a him choice. But, you know, he gets out of the carriage and suddenly he's there in the moonlight sort of thing in front of the window and the door. And I'm going, okay, so it's the Exorcist.
And he's still smoking the cigar when he's inside. I'm like, wouldn't you ask if you could, but you know, whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
But then the scene where he's talking about beheading her and he makes it into a joke. I'm like, oh, come on. That is not something to joke about. That's a line that's very serious where he's trying to convince them that this is how it's done or it's not going to work. And he throws it away like a throwaway joke.
Okay. I would give you that one because that one does kind of hit the beat hits wrong for me too. I agree with that. But like all of his other ones work. All of the fights work. The scenes with Mina and the wives works for me. It's interesting that there's not an adversarial scene in this. There's not the Van Helsing versus Dracula scene in this, like we've gotten in every other vampire movie. And no, I have that in my keys as that's a missing key to me in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I loved about the Olivier Langella was that whole scene. I loved the scene in the original 31. That's when he does the whole knock the cigar box down and all of that whole adversarial thing with Van Helsing. And that's not in this.
I would argue that Anthony Hopkins was having a midlife crisis when he made this movie, because you talk about how they all got together to rehearse and fraternize and get into character before this movie. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, he is the mentor to three young strapping suitors. And all of a sudden, he's like, wait a minute, I want to be the young hot guy too. And he's like trying to be like them instead of leading them.
Could have been.
That's what it feels like to me. I feel like he's either having a midlife crisis or he's a ham or both. Because I think he overplayed it.
Or you see him in the downslide coming from an entire career that has peaked with winning the Oscar, which is only, what, a year before this, 2 years before?
It was just a year earlier, yeah.
Right. So now he's in the downside of what projects do you pick? How do you go? Where do you go from here?
Mm-hmm.
How do you, A, differentiate this guy from this character that you're going to be known for the rest of eternity? So maybe he wanted the humorous angle or the twisted angle to do. Yeah, I agree with you. I think there's definitely something going wrong that, because normally he's so on point every beat of every scene.
He is. He's a marvelous actor. I love him dearly, but in this, I don't. And, I'll just say it again. Well, I think Peter Cushing is the best Van Helsing.
Who else really did they have? Who else were they considering?
Liam Neeson was one.
I could see that.
I could see that in a heartbeat. And this is before he became, action hero Taken guy.
Yeah.
But after Anthony Hopkins was still, writing the success of Silence of the Lambs and showed a little bit of interest, Neeson was turned down. So Neeson.
Dang. I don't know. That might have been a better choice, I think, to strengthen it, but still could not have gotten rid of the Keanu thing, but there you go.
No, the Keanu thing is what is the anchor of this movie. And that is what drags. When I say anchor, I mean that in a derogatory way. I mean it sinks.
Oh, okay.
It
it does. Yes.
No, he doesn't hold the movie. He sinks the movie.
Yes. Yes. She's the iceberg of this movie.
I also have that. Oh, I know. And we know this. For those of you who have not seen this movie in a while, Hopkins also plays the priest who tells Dracula that Elizabeth's soul is condemned.
Yes, he's also the captain on the Demeter.
Yes,
he's on the ship.
He is the captain narrating the Demeter sequence as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, so they used Anthony. They got their money's worth out of Mr. Hopkins, is what they did. I mentioned Keanu Reeves. The only other person up for that we know of was Johnny Depp, but the studio wanted a mainstream heartthrob. And like David said, I guess it also could have depended when movies landed for each of these young men, because they were both coming in to fashion at about the same time.
Oh, yeah.
So, and I think Edward Scissorhands was 92, but it may have been 90. I cannot remember.
Okay.
We have great supporting cast. Love Cary Elwes as Arthur Holmwood. Love Richard E. Grant in anything he does. And I am a huge Billy Campbell fan, and a lot of people don't even know who he is.
Have him watch Rocketeer. Oh, my God. He's phenomenal in that movie. Yeah.
Well, I love him because he was in the Tales of the City miniseries that aired in the 90s with Laura Linney. It's based on Armistead Maupin's books, the Tales of the City books. And I'm just a huge fan of those books. And he – I can't remember his character's name. But anyway, he starred in it as one of the lead characters in those books. So I know him from those – they originated on PBS and were continued on Showtime and now continued on Netflix. Anyway, so I like Billy Campbell. As you mentioned, Sadie Frost played Lucy.
Oh, my God.
Is great, but there was another choice, which I'm not sure I agree with or disagree with, so I want to know your opinion.
Oh, God. Yes?
Juliette Lewis was considered.
I wouldn't cast her with Winona, but she could do Lucy, yeah. I wouldn't have a problem with her at all playing Lucy.
Are you saying you wouldn't cast her because they have the same color hair? Why
no, they're just similar. They're similar in facial structure. They're similar in...
Winona's prettier. Juliet's not really
much prettier. Much prettier. But again, that's the problem with the thing. Lucy should be prettier. Lucy is a socialite. Well,
Lucy should be sluttier.
Well, okay. But you, yes.
Not necessarily prettier. Sexual, more sexual than Mina. Mina's more wholesome. Lucy's more sexual.
I think Juliette Lewis would have torn up the frickin' evil scenes. I think
she would have tossed
awesome
that baby.
That.
She wouldn't have dropped that baby. She would have tossed that baby.
She would have broken its arm off and been nibbling on it while she's talking to him. You know, yeah. I mean, she's good. I think she would have had fun with that and done
she
that.
She would have gone, are you flirting with me?
I just don't.
I swear, I could watch Natural Born Killers over and over and over. That's one of my all-time favorite movies.
She might have struggled a bit with the British, maybe, or she might have struggled. Yeah. I don't know. I just wouldn't. If I was casting it, I wouldn't. And I'd already cast Mina, then she would be out. I would have to find somebody else. Because, I mean, Sadie Frost is a brunette. They gave her the red hair for the movie. She's a brunette, so, but it works for her. I think it makes her very dynamic and very unique.
Oh, she's fantastic. I mean, I'm not saying it should be recast. I just love imagining Juliette Lewis in that part.
Yeah. Well, Sadie Frost was the one even thinking about it when for this podcast and going back in my research and I was going, why did she not become bigger like everyone else? Because she was really strong in this and really good and memorable. And I don't know why she didn't, go on and do more stuff. I don't know what happened to her career. So there you go.
I have one more casting note that I think you will find interesting. Tom Waits, who is normally a musician, but sometimes actor, he was cast as Renfield. Mm-hmm. he's not particularly memorable to me. Do you know who was offered the role but turned it down?
You're gonna turned be it like, down? Turned Francis Ford Coppola down? Who?
Steve Buscemi. He would have been great.
He would have been great.
He would have been so good.
Mm-hmm.
Did I ever tell you I was in an elevator with him once?
No. Were you?
Yeah. I was in Philadelphia, and I happened to be in an elevator, and Steve Buscemi, and I guess his manager or his agent was with him, and he was pissed off. I don't know what he was mad about, but they were, like, arguing or something, and I just kind of hid in the back corner of the elevator and let it go. I mean, I didn't even say hi.
Wow.
Yeah, it was weird.
He would have been perfect for this, but I do think that's another negative to this movie is Renfield is totally useless in this movie. There's no reason for him to be in it, and I don't know why Hart chose that. Again, why didn't he choose a big standoff scene between Van Helsing and Dracula? And why isn't Renfield at least have a reason for him to be here.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I like the whole not prologue, but right after the prologue, where we find out the reason Harker is going is because Renfield kind of lost his frickin' mind and didn't seal the deal for the real estate. So we got to send Harker to save the company, essentially. So his mandate was seal his deal with Count Dracula and get all these properties sold. That's what we need to do. But if Renfield had then been doing something when he came back to England and had some reason for being in the story other than just Dracula's
yelling
kill
out
you.
A window. I mean, it's all he does in the whole movie is master, master. And I'm like, that's another scene that I don't like. It's because they do it like three times.
Yes. And he doesn't do anything. If he did something, you know, and even to the point of, then why does Dracula kill him? Makes no sense. He hasn't done anything. Right. He didn't give anything away. He didn't tell anything. So, you know, in the past versions, Dracula kills him because he betrays him. He ends up saying that telling Mina everything about Carfax Abbey and the boxes and all of that. And that's why, you know, Dracula kills him. And that doesn't happen in this. And so we're going, why does he even bother? Get on the boat or get on the horses and let's go.
No, it's like, oh, I get to be the actor that eats bugs and screams master.
But I thought Waits was fine. I mean, he was fine in the role. He gave him, I liked him being bespeckled. I thought that was kind of a cool add-on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he ate good bugs.
But Steve Buscemi would have brought the Dwight Fry energy.
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely.
Big dive. Yeah. Well, and he just has that. Buscemi can play creepy, but he can also play endearing as well. And as we talked about Dwight Fry, he was endearing in that first version back in 31.
Oh, yeah. 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 We need to feel something for Renfield, but without any lines to support that or any scenes to support that, who cares?
Yeah. The character has kind of become a characterization, I can't say the word.
Caricature
of itself. Yeah.
Yeah.
A caricature. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. That's all I have on cast. Well, I told you I had a good bit.
You did have a good bit. That's good, though.
I've got some awards. This movie did have a lot of award type mojo because it's Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah.
I mentioned, as far as Academy Awards, it won Best Costume Design and it won Best Effects, Sound Effects and Editing. So some of those practical things came into play. It also won Best Makeup, which was Greg Cannon. We know that name.
Yep.
From horror movie stuff. It was nominated for Best Art Direction. I'm not sure what it lost to, but I could see why it was nominated.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
As far as BAFTAs, it did not win any, but it was nominated for a lot. Costume, art, makeup, production, special effects. Our friends over at the Saturn Awards gave it several. They gave it Best Horror Film, Best Actor Gary Oldman, Best Director Coppola, Best Writing Hart, and Best Costumes Ishioka. I believe that's how you said.
Yeah, Ishioka.
Yep. Ishioka. And then Winona Ryder and Anthony Hopkins were both nominated for supporting roles. Mm-hmm. And it was nominated for Best Music, which you liked. I liked it too. And Best Makeup and Special Effects. And then lastly, I won't go into all the other weird circuit awards. This one is on the 1001 Must See Before You Die movie list.
Probably because of Coppola, but also because of, I think it deserves that, I think, for a lot of reasons.
I mean, I don't hate this movie. I have a love-hate relationship with this movie. Mm-hmm. Very similar to Interview with a Vampire, where I think parts of it are spectacular and parts of it are not.
Yeah.
And I want to like it, and I do think it deserves to be seen, just like I think Interview deserves to be seen, regardless of the fact that Tom Cruise is in it.
I've got another vampire, not cliche, but, you know, a vampire tenet of the species or whatever that they didn't do or didn't make sense to me, which was he obviously doesn't cast a reflection. Because, you know, Jonathan is shaving and doesn't see him behind him,
kind of
thing. But then when they cut to the scene behind you, the cinematograph scene, the setup, the transition to that is him being filmed. And it's like with a cinematoscope camera, you know, with all the glitchiness and the kind of fat. And I was going, okay, so wait, he doesn't cast a reflection, but you can film him with a camera?
I hadn't thought about that, but you're right.
That didn't work to me.
It would have been funny if it was just the clothing and not him.
Yeah.
Like you saw the hat floating or something.
I've got in my notes, I think this would have made a really, I think glass. This makes a really good, take the stupid glasses off. I think this makes a really good screenplay to study. I love some of the lines. I love some of the dialogue that they have. Even if you exclude him, Van Helsing dancing with Mina the first time he sees her, their dialogue is really good. You know, the thing about you're a light in this world, there's darkness and that's light. You're one of the lights. So go to your friend, you know, kind of thing. Just that.
I think they could have used Hopkins as Van Helsing a little better.
I think, yes,
like
I agree.
Like that dancing scene and the scene where he's seduced, I think it would have been more powerful if he was able to resist her seduction and realize what was going on.
Yes, agreed. But dialogue like Dracula saying there's much to be learned from beasts. You know, the big line everybody quotes, which is, I've crossed oceans of time to find you.
Yeah, I started to lead with that, and I was like, I've crossed oceans of cyberspace to find you, David.
Even Hopkins at the end, when he's beheaded these women and everything else, and he says, we've all become God's madmen, which I think is in the novel. I'm not certain, but it's a great line.
It is a great line.
So keys then, because okay. I've
well,
got
we
tons
need to go back.
Of,
a little
oh,
bit.
Wait, sorry. Before we do keys, I got one last thing, which sure. is Mina Lucy vomits blood all over Van Helsing. Did you like that scene?
Yeah, that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. That was very Exorcist.
Oh, I loved
that's
it.
That's a key right there.
That's Exorcist. A good key. Yeah, Exorcist yeah. key. Yeah.
Because it was like. The fact that it was blood, we had not really seen it before.
Uh-huh.
Yep. I mean, not in what you would call a respectable horror movie anyway.
Correct.
I had one other trivia thing. Oh, before we move on to keys, let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
And you may like this. It makes sense. You know how we've talked about how directors are friends and they get together and watch movies and say, oh, I think I would do that. We talked about it with Brian De Palma.
Yeah.
And
all of them were Coppola, De Palma, Spielberg, Lucas.
But who was it that suggested something to Brian De Palma? I can't remember what it was. Anyway,
no, Brian De Palma suggested to George Lucas that he have a prologue before his little
Star Wars
thing.
Right. Yep. Right. So it's a major thing. Well, something very similar happened in this movie. Producer, director Francis Ford Coppola screened it for his close friend, George Lucas, who suggested that to make it a little more powerful at the end, it should be Mina that decapitates Dracula. For the ultimate release and his reaching heaven, so to speak. And Coppola agreed and took three and shot it in 3 weeks before the movie was released. So
yeah, you don't like the romance, but I liked that part of it. That was really good. That was very, very sad. Very, I love it when she leaves him and he's reading her letter again, homage to the epistolatory, you know, telling, and he's crying blood. Loved that. Thought that was cool.
That's very Anne Rice.
Yeah. Yep. Very, very Anne Rice.
So I guess
good
I should
key
put
there.
Anne Rice. That should be just a key right there. Anne Rice.
It should be. Yes. Yeah. But I liked her killing him. There's a great, Everything Wrong with Coppola's Dracula, or one of those that I watched. And it's talking through that last scene and it says, don't ever let it be said that Mina Murray is swayed by beauty, because she, you know, she leans down and kisses him and he's got a slit throat and blood all over his mouth. And he's that old kind of semi old and semi bat kind of look makeup. And she kisses him right on the mouth.
The whole time she did it, I thought it's going to taste like rubber. Because she's kissing basically latex is what she's kissing. It's not real. And I was like, that's kind of gross.
Or it would be an old ghoul with blood on his mouth and you're kissing it. Same thing.
Well, I mean, that you would know. Be if it were real.
It is real, Tim. This movies are real.
All right. I'm going to go back to just in case I have keys for the first one. This is a key that we mentioned when we covered Nosferatu last season. Okay. And that is that a lot of vampire movies came out this year in 1979, including this one, Nosferatu, Love at First Bite, the George Hamilton spoof, a movie called Nocturna, which I don't know anything about. It's probably foreign. And Dracula Blows His Cool.
Oh, well, can't miss
and
that.
And also a movie, Vlad Tepes, came out, which was a Romanian movie that was sort of a historical feature. 1979 also saw the release of two other vampire movies, one called Thirst, no relation to the Robert McCammon book, and our favorite, Salem's Lot. So there were a lot of vampire movies in 1979.
Vampires were big when I graduated high school. Look at that. Yeah, maybe that's part of my upbringing. Yeah. So it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have that many keys. I've got a few. I've got Burning the Cross on the Forehead. That's obviously a key back to the Hammer version. And that's in the 79, mm-hmm. of course. And then we do it with the Wafer in the Coppola version.
And I didn't have a problem with that. I thought that was kind of cool how it left that imprint on Winona's forehead.
Yeah, and we know that he's finally dead because it goes away mm-hmm. at the end. You know,
that was a nice touch, actually.
I thought that was a nice touch and very mm-hmm. romantic and very good. The No Fangs, of course, similar, like you already said, similar to the original 31 version. Salem's Lot, all three of these have a burning cross in them that the vampire creates in some way. So that's kind of interesting.
Where's a burning cross in Salem's Lot?
Well, in Salem's Lot, he grabs the cross.
He grabs it and like bends it.
But that whole confrontation over the cross being insignificant, I guess, mm-hmm. Or not a good weapon. And then the only other one I've got from the 79 version is, James Bond as a key because the,
Donald
choreography. Yeah, Blofeld. Blofeld, is eating the cat in all of the James Bond movies. No. But now you've made me think, I wonder if that's why he had the cat as Blofeld.
So you can't cut away from him.
So you can't cut away from him. He's petting that damn cat. The big love scene we talk about in 79 with the laser and the red and everything was choreographed by the same guy that did all of the James Bond credit sequences. That's why it looks like that. As a matter of fact, somebody even said, if you took a James Bond song, any James Bond song, you know, one of their hits, Spy Who Loves Me or whatever, you could put under this and it would look exactly the same.
Well, the Spy Who Loved Me would be perfect too, because it's the same era.
Yeah. Yeah. Use that late 70s kind of sound.
Carly Simon. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. So those are my keys from 79.
My other ones from 79 are ones I'm just going to recap ones we mentioned already. Uh-huh. Ken Russell, obviously. You mentioned The Who's Laser, which I find funny. Ghost Story. We were talking about, elder respected actors coming in and doing horror movies with Laurence Olivier. Mm-hmm. Greek mythology, as far as the Medusa-esque reflection in the water, and The Devil Rides Out, as far as that damn car being everywhere, riding around the English countryside.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Midnight Mass because of the cape flying away at the end.
Or the setup sequel. Yeah.
Right. Potential sequel. And then moving forward, what about keys for this one?
Well, it's interesting. You said Medusa, and there's definitely a Medusa reference in the Coppola one, because one of the brides has snakes in her hair.
Yes.
And they actually move. So, I mean, she literally is Medusa in it.
Yeah,
so
I agreed with that. I'd forgotten about that earlier and forgot to mention it. Yeah.
Let's see. I have, and some of these I actually took from research, and two of them I have a question about, so I want to know if you may know. But one is, there's definitely a shining key for me because at the beginning of 79, or in 79, I mean, in the Coppola version, you know, when Dracula arrives, they're running through a hedge maze. That's where the girls are running through. So that was a very key for me. Exorcist twice, not only with Van Helsing's arrival, but then with Lucy doing the blood vomit.
Yeah.
A key that's Coppola on Coppola, which is the whole cutting from a religious ceremony to a tragedy happening at the same time. So we are cutting between this wedding of Jonathan and Mina
at the convent.
Yes, to Dracula killing Lucy and everything and going back and forth with him becoming the wolf and actually ripping her throat out and all of that. So it's this very Coppola kind of juxtaposition, which I think works. It was very dramatic. It worked for me.
Yeah. Didn't he do something similar with Marlon Brando in The Godfather?
Yeah, that's the ending, not with Marlon, with but the ending of The Godfather is cutting between Michael's becoming the godfather to his sister's baby and the whole religious ceremony while all of his men are killing the heads of the five families.
Killing people, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, blowing them away and shooting them and strangling them.
I was thinking that something heinous was going on when Brando was playing with his grandchild, too, when he has the
Well, that's when he dies. Oh, that's when the godfather
That's
dies.
Just what I'm thinking then. I haven't seen that movie in a long time.
I watch it at least once, if not twice a year. It is probably, as we've said before, my favorite movie of all time is The Godfather. God. Yep.
We're going to need a bigger boat.
I adore that movie in so many ways. Jaws will be second. Keys. Okay, I've got Rising from the Coffin. The first time we see Dracula in Transylvania Rise from the Coffin is exactly the same way we see him in Nosferatu.
Well, I was going to get to that because Francis Ford Coppola even says that his main influence for the cinematography of this movie is the Murnau version of Nosferatu from 1922. And that's why he lifted that scene of him rising up out of the casket the same way.
Yeah, of coming just full out, straight up. You know,
but I mean, if you think
about it. And also the shadows.
Exactly what I was going to say. All that shadow play, he lifted from Nosferatu because we saw it in Nosferatu. It may not have been as playful with different things happening, but there was tons of shadow work in it for sure.
Oh, yeah. And I think it's very, you could definitely see that. Very Nosferatu. Mm-hmm. It's kind of me, but the glass coffin kind of reminded me of Snow White. It was a very Snow White kind of,
because she's always fairy-tale-esque,
fairy tale kind of thing, especially with that big kabuki collar kind of look or Victorian collar on
it. It was almost like one of those Iago collars gone crazy.
Yeah.
Like the car filter thing, only much larger air filter.
And I have one that says that Coppola was inspired for the impaling scene. I'm not sure which is the impaling scene by the movie Shadow of Nosferatu. Not Nosferatu, but another one that was Shadow of Nosferatu. So I don't know. I don't remember ever seeing Shadow of Nosferatu, so I can't remember.
Oh, you must. Maybe, are you thinking of Shadow of the Vampire?
No.
There's a movie called Shadow of the Vampire where Willem.
But that's the making. That's him being the guy that played Nosferatu.
Yeah, it's Willem Dafoe playing Max Schreck.
Yes.
And I almost said Steve Buscemi, but it's Willem Dafoe because they do remind me of each other. I thought maybe you just had the title confused. Maybe it was from Shadow of
Vampire. Well, I may have in my notes, but that's what it says in my notes. Impaling scene inspired by Shadow of Nosferatu.
I will write that down and try to look it up
And
see if it's a movie.
So, I might be totally wrong, but it came from my research somehow.
Nosferatu.
Nosferatu.
Yeah, Nosferatu was the main one I had for this one. I can go back and recoup. I take that back. If I had to say anything is a key to this one, the largest key is going to be Anne Rice. I mean, from all the romance and eroticism. There's not very much homoeroticism at all, which is more prevalent in the Anne Rice stuff. But even that picture of him in those stupid glasses behind me is very, I mean, it is almost lifted from the scene in, who is the guy that did Interview? Neil Jordan, the guy that did Company of Wolves. That scene where, Louis and Lestat and Claudia are walking the streets at night, all dressed to the nines. Lestat is wearing that hat. It may be a different color, but it's almost the exact same outfit that is completely lifted from the movie version of Interview with the Vampire. So Anne Rice all over. And then to recap, You mentioned The Exorcist and The Shining, and Fairy Tales, and just Nosferatu. It's amazing that we go back not to Todd Browning's original Dracula, but further back to Nosferatu with this one. Don't you find that kind of fun and intriguing? I do.
Yes. I keep thinking we also should mention Twilight. She was obviously... And
because of Keanu, no.
And like we have done with the other three, we have to mention the every other vampire movie ever made.
Right. I mean, we can't list them all, but if you want to list Twilight because it's a franchise, fuck it, we will. I mean, I would list Twilight because it's got bad actors in it, just like Keanu Reeves, namely Kristen Stewart. Yeah, I mean, there's True Blood. I mean, there's just so many, we can't list them all.
Correct.
Buffy, Dark Shadows. Some of these I may have mentioned in the double feature we did last week, and they'll be listed in there as well. So,
but in case we're missing keys, all of you guys out there listening or watching, let us know. Get in touch with us. And please, like we said at the beginning, if you give us even a two-word review, it means a lot to us and helps us keep this going. A little ding, a comment, a text. So make sure that you come back and see us, register with us, subscribe, ring the bell, do all those kind of fun things. And we appreciate you listening. Next week, we'll be in a totally different world, and it'll be interesting to see where we go from here. But we've enjoyed you putting up with four Dracula movies out of the thousands that have been made.
And this episode's been like 2 hours long.
2 hours long. You know, an hour on each. So there you go. Tim, thank you for doing it.
Hey, I enjoy it every week.
All right. Talk to you next week.
All right. See you. Bye.